Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
What could be easier?
Hi, hello, how are you? It's Daryl, and welcome back, yes, back to Cage Rage Revisited, episode 4, the mini-series within a series in which I go back to some of the older Nicolas Cage movies that I covered at the start of the podcast, Cage Rage, the Nicolas Cage podcast, episodes where I didn't have guests, episodes where I don't know if I really did justice, so I wanted to go back, right the wrongs of history, be on the right side of history, and give these Cage movies the recognition, the time that they deserve. And it is time, finally, for episode 4 of Cage Rage Revisited, where we take a look back at Raising Arizona. Sorry it's taken a little while to get round to this one. In fact, this one was recorded a little while ago. I've only recently had time to put all the pieces together, get this one edited, uploaded, as it is now being ingested into your ears. But what an episode we have. What a fun time it was. We had returning guests of the podcast, Kevin and Aaron from the podcast That Wouldn't Die, who returned to join me to speak about Raising Arizona, that old wacky 80s Cage classic. And in this episode, we'll be talking about our perceptions of Arizona based on this movie, 1980s Cage hair, Woody Woodpecker tattoos, and so much more. It's always a fun one, a wild old time, when the podcast That Wouldn't Die joins on the ever-extending journey to true Cage Nirvana. I would also like to take this opportunity at this point in the intro to the episode to give a quick shout-out to Liam Shardlow of X Parrot Press, who very kindly reached out and sent a copy of a Nicolas Cage-inspired anthology called His Soul's Still Dancing. This is an anthology, a book curated from authors of all spectrums, all nationalities, who have all come together and contributed their own stories on the golden hog of Hollywood, Nicolas Cage. You'll get stories about the movies Nick never made, psychodramas of his own making, his history delved into and twisted back through his own manic stare, clones, giant gaping maws, blood, dancing, lizards, sharks, heat-seeking panthers, Bob Denver on acid playing the accordion, and everything in between. So thank you again to the kind folk at X Parrot Press for sending out a free copy of this book. It's a lovely bit of work. We all need some more Nick Cage in our lives. So get on this, get involved, go and support His Soul Still Dancing, a Nicolas Cage inspired anthology. Links in the description down below. You can find it on Amazon. And treat yourself some Nick Cage stories, some Nick Cage goodness in the year of our Golden Hog and Lord 2024. Rest assured, the Dream Scenario episode is coming. It's in the works. Apologies, it's taken a little longer than anticipated, but it's all ticking along behind the scenes. The wheels are in motion, the gears are turning. And obviously, since we've been away, we've had the trailer for Arcadian, the trailer for Long Legs, and both look to be some little delightful horror tidbits from our horror star boy, our big boy, Nicolas Cage, the Golden Hog of Hollywood. Both dropping in the year of our Golden Hog Lord 2024. Cannot wait to get me dirty little balls into them. But you've waited enough for an episode, so let's get into it. I'll jump in at the end, just to check in with you. But here we are, Cage Rage Revisited, episode 4, Raising Arizona, with a podcast That Wouldn't Die. I'll talk to you at the end, but for now, enjoy. Duh.
We We head back to 1987 this week to take another look at the crime comedy Raising Arizona. Cage plays H.I. McDonough, an ex-con who falls in love with a cop before taking some drastic measures to start a family. Now returning on the journey to true cage nirvana this week to see if this movie is raising our hopes or has us Arizoning out, it's Kevin and Aaron from the podcast That Wouldn't Die. Welcome back, both. How have you been? How are you doing?
Thanks for having us.
We've been
counting the moments till we can come back in our search for cage nirvana, let me tell you.
How far we've come. We were just talking off record. How far we've come since the Humanity Bureau. It feels like a lifetime ago and only yesterday at the same time.
That's right.
I feel like it's kind of a point of order now for returning guests. I have to give you something trash first. You've got to work through, pay your dues.
You got to prove it. You got to prove your worth.
You got to prove that you want to be here.
That's right.
I
had never even heard of the Humanity Bureau when you suggested it. I'm like, what the hell is this movie?
Which is shocking because Kevin's spirit animal is Nick Cage.
Well, absolutely, that's true. No question. But Raising Arizona, arguably one of my favorite movies of all time. I love it.
Agreed.
Raising Arizona, for a lot of people, is top tier Cage. So I think, you know, I think I might be able to guess some answers here, but I take it for you both on those little tidbits of information that this is not your first time seeing Raising Arizona.
Oh, no. I saw it in the 80s. I remember them talking about it on Siskel and Ebert at the movies. And it seemed so bizarre. And we watched it. And this is young Nick Cage. This might have been one of his first, like, I'm a big star performances. And the Coen brothers, of course.
Yes.
This is like,
still, I think this might be one of their best.
I go a step further. I think this might be straight up the best Coen brothers movie.
Because it started getting a little shittier right after this.
Others might disagree, but okay.
I guess.
Well, I think the Coen brothers said in my quick Google of information for the episode that this was, I think it would be another 20 years until a film of theirs made some like serious cash at the box office as well. So this one, I think it was about $5.5 million that this one was made for, made just under $30 million. So the people of 87 were out there for Raising Arizona. I looked into this when this released. I think it was Friday the 13th of 1987. This released.
Perfect.
Same weekend as Evil Dead 2 came out. They were just at 14 and 15 together. And I think it was Lethal Weapon and Nightmare on Elm Street 3 were still at the top spot there. So
that's a heck of a lineup. I'll tell you what.
So
there was a lot going on in 87.
87, a busy, busy year. I think Platoon was knocking around in the top 10 there. Willem Dafoe, never heard of that guy. I don't know why. busy at the box office, and then it sort of dropped off. So it's one of those that I don't think critics really liked it at the time. Raising Arizona, I felt it was a bit too much going on, or a bit not enough going on, a bit style over substance.
It's all lies. All lies.
Well, it's wacky. Is the best way I can describe it.
It is, you know, so I mean? Unique, especially for that time. Because you really didn't know. It's kind of Wes Anderson-esque, you know? It is just so different than anything that was out there at the time, which is why it is so delightful.
Well, and also, I think the Coen brothers had done, like, Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing, which were these kind of, like, heavy drama crime things. And this is very light. I mean, if you ignore what the plot's about, which doesn't sound light at all, child abduction.
Hilarious.
Right. They took and shined a light, a comedic light on child abduction, which I think was overdue, in my opinion. So that's important.
Yeah, it was like the Lindbergh kidnapping, except no one died.
Right. Just like it. Exactly.
Just like it.
Very topical.
It's, It was about time that someone cast a positive light on children being stolen. I think up until, you know, up until 86, like, oh God, child abduction. It's so, so sad. I wish someone would just do something and make me laugh about children being abducted again.
That's exactly right.
The Coen brother said, I'll take that bet.
I like it. You know, we're just helping you. We're trying to ease your burden. It was really what this is about. It's about, you know, people helping other people.
It's also interesting you talked about Evil Dead 2 opened up that same week, because there's kind of the Coen brothers and Sam Raimi are all kind of connected together. Like they were like roommates at the time. I think the Coen brothers helped edit Crime Wave, which was another Sam Raimi Coen brothers co-production.
I don't think I've seen that.
It's not a very good movie.
Okay.
Can't all be winners.
Gotta take the rough with the smooth, which really summarizes my podcasting experience of Nicolas Cage's films. You've really got to take the rough with the smooth to appreciate the highs and the lows. Yeah, I think that the Coens and the Raimi bloodlines are very closely interlinked. I know they've all worked on each other's films in some capacity. Mm-hmm. Even in this film, there are outright camera work that is directly influenced by Raimi, sort of the Francesca Arizona, the mother of the Arizona Quints. The camera zooms and goes over the car and then like,
oh yeah,
up the ladder, right in the mouth.
A delight. You're not going to really anticipate what they're going to show you next. When the prisoners are escaping and they're like giving birth out onto the desert floor, that is just amazing. And Dan Connor from Roseanne.
They tunneled like little hedgehogs, like literally digging through the earth? Is that what they did?
They tunneled
Shawshank.
They said the
it was Shawshank Redemption. This is Stephen King's earlier work.
I believe they said the correctional facility had nothing further to offer them, so they tunneled out.
They released themselves on their own recognizance. This movie is so quotable. Literally, that's what I started just writing down, because I realized there are so many lines in this movie that I still quote just randomly today, like non sequiturs, and people turn to me like, what the hell are you talking about?
And you don't explain and you walk away.
Don't. Her womb was a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase.
Do you use that in the classroom with the junior high?
All the time. This woman who looked as fertile as the Tennessee Valley. We have to talk about the crazy accents, because I don't know if you're familiar with geography of the United States, but Arizona is literally right next to California. So they
talk just like freaking California.
They do. But
I had a quick look at the map. I had a quick look at the map to get my bearings. I saw California. I saw Arizona, Utah, New Mexico.
That's correct.
And then other ones with their perfectly straight lines, all divided nice and neat.
That's how we do it.
That's how you do it. You divvy it up. Divvy it up.
But they gave them like this, these deep South accents. For some reason, it was
hilarious. They're just wacky accent. We have Holly Hunter, who's clearly not from California.
Well, that's her real accent.
That's her real accent. Right. And she never bothers. She could be playing a British detective, and that would be her accent. Absolutely. It's like Kevin Costner trying to be Robin Hood.
I mean, Nicolas Cage was from Beverly Hills. So this is an acting choice, I guess, right?
Is he trying to match Crazy Holly Hunter because now Arizona's in the Deep South?
Because why not? Right? Because why not?
Choices.
It's always all about choices when it comes to Cage. Although, speaking of the accents, I did read something. I think that the Coen brothers basically said this is how they imagined people in Arizona would speak. Basically, they've used a lot of, and it's the Coen brothers, so naturally they've used a lot of creative liberty. Yes. They said, we imagine, take the Arizonan accent. My only influence or input into what Arizona accent is based purely on this film. So I have to assume this is completely correct.
I mean, I don't think they're from California. The Coen brothers are.
No, they're from Minnesota.
They're from Minnesota, so they're in the Midwest. So actually, we judge them. But I think definitely people in California look down on people from Arizona. They're the bad drivers. That's where all the people who leave California because it's too liberal go. It's all negative, negative, negative. It's the fire crotch of hell. So of course you would move.
I don't know. It's everyone wears Hawaiian shirts from what I've seen. It seemed delightful.
That is correct.
Because it's 110 all year round.
I mean, I say this as someone who wears Hawaiian shirts unironically all year round. So this film is ticking all the boxes of my interests. yeah, finding the exact bit of information from IMDb, they said to create the character's dialect, the Coen brothers created a hybrid of local dialect and the assumed reading materials of the characters, namely magazines and the Bible.
Assumed reading materials.
That sounds about right.
So I guess the Bible is a
Arizona's not Alabama or something. You know what I mean? It's
Arizona is probably more liberal than Minnesota. Minnesota's in the Midwest. That's one of the flyover states.
The Coen brothers love messing with accents. I mean, with it, like Fargo, for example, that was a character in that movie, the crazy Minnesota accents.
Oh yeah. You betcha.
Hey, you betcha. Hey, you betcha. Which to me means
which is no lie. Literally, that's real.
That's real.
They have developed because it was like Scandinavian settled there, so they've developed their own weird American. Yeah.
Minnesota sounds so charming, though. It sounds just so quirky.
Yes.
I feel like I have to learn all of my like USA knowledge from you guys. I'm like, it sounds great. Look, I guess I've heard it's cold, but they all sound very chipper.
They do.
I'd love to go.
We have to remember that as Californians, we think we possess the only true and correct accents as part of the
And we are in the greatest state in the United States. We are at the apex.
We are the apex.
You ski in the morning, you're sitting at the beach in the afternoon. We have literally every climate and we are in a giant state. It's about 20 hours from like San Diego to the Oregon border.
That sounds like way too much state for me.
It is huge.
That's a lot of state.
Oh, and there's a battle. Northern California always wants to leave Southern California. San Francisco hates LA. LA is oblivious and could care less.
Why can't we all just get along, California?
I agree. Aaron has very strong opinions on these things, as you could tell.
Doesn't matter. I have lots of opinions on many things. Doesn't matter if I have any knowledge to back it up. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me for the facts. It feels right, so it's true.
You've led your life with your heart. And that's the noble thing here. It doesn't matter if it holds up in a court of law.
That's right. Don't quote me, but people are saying.
We come from a long line of frontiersmen and outdoor types. Okay, so
right. We come from a long line of like attorneys. We don't know how to do home repair. We don't know how to change the oil in our car. If society shuts down, we're the first to go. We'll just lay in the street and wait for the zombies to pick our corpse.
This took a dark turn.
But, you lived life on your terms, though. That's the important thing. You lived life with no Californian regrets.
Absolutely not.
You let your neighboring states worry about that. Was it Utah? Are we spitting on Utah? I don't know.
For sure we're spitting on Utah. We're spitting on, I would say every state that leans up against California is generally not as good. Some worse than others. You got Nevada. What does Nevada have to offer me? It has Vegas, which is terrible. You have Arizona, which we've already discussed. And I have personal knowledge as I lived there for 3 years. I don't think Utah abuts us. But Oregon, you have Portland And then you have the rest of the state, which is, I'm sure, white supremacists and I don't know. It's just madness.
Aaron's views do not represent the views of this podcast or of me, her brother, by the way.
Yes, they do.
We live for a passionate opinion on the podcast. So if you're unlucky enough to be bordering California, get fucked, basically.
That's Aaron's. That's
what,
Aaron's.
Is what we're learning tombstone. Here today.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly what we're learning, though, is, you know, Arizona, the dreams might happen in Utah. California, I think, has got to sort out its own stuff. There's a lot of internal struggles happening. But I was reading about this movie as well, that when it came out, apparently the good people of Arizona were none too thrilled.
Imagine that.
Shocking.
I think it was, they didn't like the way it portrayed people in the state of Arizona. And they said politicians got involved as well.
I'm sure.
I don't know if this person is still a politician, but the then mayor of Scottsdale, Herb Dinkwater, damned the film, stating it certainly isn't the image Arizona wants to project.
I'm guessing that's probably true.
Well, Scottsdale's a really nice area. Yeah. That's
where the rich white Californians go, so they can just play golf all the time.
So we didn't want to upset Scottsdale for the richest of us in California. We still want our golf privileges to be opened up. But no, they.
I love that they described the trailer park as beautiful suburban Tempe. Where it was just like in the middle of the desert, like vast expanse, and then one trailer. That's suburban Tempe. Tempe's also like a suburb of Phoenix.
They're all like squished together. Right. It's like Scottsdale, Phoenix, Tempe. They all just kind of flow into each other. So it's a major, I mean, I was there in the 80s. It's a major metropolitan area.
It is.
That's why that's so funny.
It is. Millions of people live there.
I mean, what I'd love to know is have the, you know, it's been we're coming up to 40 years, 35, 40 years. The people of Arizona, have you healed from this movie yet? Have you been able to move on? Has there been any other movie that's caught your wrath? You didn't like the way that you portrayed? I don't know.
No, they've just gotten angrier and angrier baking in that sun.
I know. Revenge of the Nerds was filmed at Arizona State University, and they weren't thrilled about that either, so, if I remember correctly.
So does Arizona appreciate any kind of film being made there, any kind of footage of their town, their state? They just hate being seen, is what I'm learning about Arizona. They don't want to be seen. They want you to know that they're there, but they don't want you to talk about it.
Did Romy and Michelle, didn't they drive to like Phoenix or something for their high school reunion?
Right. I
guess that was positive. It wasn't
What was Romy and Michelle's class reunion positive as well? Who's to say?
I love that movie.
These are all movies we love, Arizonans, if you happen to be listening, by the way. So appreciate it.
We have no problem with you, Arizona. This isn't a declaration of war against Arizona. I'm just one person from the UK. I can't fight you all. You'll have to select your strongest and brightest, and then we'll arrange some coordinates and a date, and then we'll fight.
It'd be like a Squid Game situation, I imagine.
The Arizonan Squid Games. To select your best and your brightest.
That's it.
Well, part of my problem with Arizona is they used to have baseball spring training in Palm Springs where we grew up, and then now it's all in Arizona. So another strike. Boom.
Another strike for Arizona. Learn Arizona? I'm trying to understand you here, and I'm just not. You're just taking it all away.
It is a desert. I mean, frankly, Southern California through Arizona, New Mexico, Texas is just a long, like, strip of just, like, lifeless desert. Mm-hmm. So it is, it's serious business. I drove from California to New Orleans all the way across, and it was like a wasteland. No,
without stopping. How long did it take you?
33 hours to drive all the way through there. And it was like the Road Warrior. It was Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome going through there.
The sheer scale of just some of the states, the country of the US, yes, is, I'm going to have to say, it's too big. It's just too big. It should not take a day and a half to go from one place to the other. That's unacceptable. That's unacceptable to me.
And that's just in New Orleans. It's not like he's driving all the way to the Atlantic. That's even longer.
That's halfway. That's about halfway.
My goodness.
It's big. But that's also why there's such a wide expanse of, frankly, cultures and political persuasions spread across this.
So. It's really like the EU. It's like you have 10,000 countries. They all have separate laws for driving, different IDs. It's and they all think they're super independent, and some states are more jackassery than others. And
that is true.
I know. We're the biggest jackasses of them all. We're not even in the EU anymore. I've got no skin in the EU game. We decided we want to be worse off, and that's what we're going to live with. Like I said, when the zombies come for California, we've got the metaphorical zombies right now. we're just shuffling around. You know what, Arizona, maybe I've been too harsh. Maybe you've got it right. Maybe you've got it completely right. Maybe we deserve the desert wasteland that is Arizona to be just dumped right on top of us. We just need a year out, pushed out to sea, to figure it all out. And we'll either come back with answers or we'll just double down with half the populace dead, which is
move into like a Soylent Green situation. Then you're self-sustainable. Boom. Solved.
Problem solved.
And yet somehow we'd get that wrong as well.
It'd be Soylent Orange.
We'd need a Soylent of some color. have to figure out our dining situation, which actually triggers, I don't know if you saw this, triggers like, there was like an off-camera story about this. Sam McMurray in the film, who plays Glenn. I believe, yeah. H.I. McDonough's foreman, he said that during filming, him and Cage went out for dinner, and apparently they were approached by a female fan who couldn't believe that she was meeting Nick Cage, couldn't believe it was like the Nicolas Cage. And once she sort of calmed down and convinced herself it was the Golden Hog himself, she asked him for an autograph. And according to McMurray, Cage took a napkin and wrote, "Tomorrow you will die, Nick Cage."
I would frame that and treasure that.
I would frame it, put it in a glass box, put it in a safe. I suppose for the purpose of balance, as far as I can tell, Nick Cage has never talked about this publicly or otherwise himself. So
I wonder why.
So it could be true. It could be a massive falsehood. However,
it could be a rumor he spread.
This could come from Camp Cage.
Camp Cage.
Dude, I want to be part of Camp Cage. I want to be social media for Camp Cage. I just want to follow around and just watch. That's all I need.
I like the idea that like one in every 100 autographs he signs, it's a death threat. Like,
you just never know what you're going to get, right? It's roulette.
I will kill you tomorrow. Kiss your children goodbye.
The one napkin's going to say like, "Sorry, you are 100, Nick Cage." That'll be like, you know, the most, I guess, like valuable autograph, in the same way, like, you know, you get certain like Pokemon cards and stuff that are like shiny and holographic and they're worth so much more. And then you get them sent off and valued. If there's someone that's, you can send off like autographs to, and they're like, "This is a 10 out of 10 condition, Nicolas Cage, one of a kind death threat autograph."
Also, do you need to call the police? And I'll say no.
Absolutely.
No. My card has been marked. This is the only way I accept death. Yes. As if it comes from, you know, the grim cage reaper himself.
Can we
Does it mean that if Cage actually goes before you, that you're immortal, or the ghost of Cage will come and collect you later on?
Well, I am convinced that Cage is immortal anyway.
Oh, well, there you go. He's like the Highlander.
There can only be one. He will come for me. Like, the black cloak is over his head. He's got like a scythe made of some exotic animal bone or something, some dinosaur bone scythe. Just, I've come for your
bone. Oh, Terry Gilliam.
Very much so. And I'd say, I don't know how old I am in this scenario, but, you know, I'm like 85 or something. And I'm like,
I got one.
It's like, I've been waiting for this day. Scythe right on my doorstep, grandchildren screaming. I'm in the doorway just smiling, and my last word is, yeah. Finally.
podcast,
that'd be the way to go.
This podcast is the Raising Arizona podcast.
What a terrific endorsement.
We talk about Nick. Is this the first, like, crazy hair Nicolas Cage movie?
I'd have to say probably is. I mean, I think one of you sort of touched on it earlier. Like, this is young Cage.
Yes.
This is sort of, you know, just, he was still breaking through. I think this was probably the movie that really, really put him on the map. Or it certainly got more people talking about him. Mm-hmm. And he'd had that sort of longer hair previously. This is like quintessential, like, Nicolas Cage 80s hair. And he had those youthful, sort of more boyish looks. Mm-hmm. He had a decent mane on him in Birdie, if I remember correctly. But Valley Girl, very nice head of hair.
Mm-hmm. He's so punk.
Very, very, very. And we're coming up to the 40th anniversary of Valley Girl as well this year at the time of recording. Yeah. So lots of Cage celebrations to be had. mark my words. I think certainly in terms of hair, this was, I suppose, the first time it was, dare I say, intentionally wilder. I've talked about this a lot on the podcast. I've watched all the films in chronological order. I've seen his hair come. I've seen it go. I've seen it come again.
Like Jesus.
just
like Jesus, like an ocean wave on the beach, coming in, coming out, majestic in its own way. This was like wilder hair. I think it goes into that he wanted to be basically the human characteristic of, or the human character version of Woody Woodpecker,
right?
Has the woodpecker tattoo. And I read as well, speaking of the hair, that if he said something about that the hair would get wilder depending on how stressed H.I. McDonough was in a scene. So I was watching with that in mind, and I was like, huh, well, what do you know? Yeah, it does.
Like Gene Wilder and Willy Wonka. He starts, his hair has been like pressed down, and by the end, it's just pieces are just standing up.
I mean, his hair is crazy just in general, like in his life. Like, I, as a child, I took for granted that, you know, people just, all actors had full heads of hair, no matter how crazy their hair looked. Mm-hmm. But wasn't, I mean, it must have been about this time where it was clear he was losing his hair. Like, it's almost like a kind of a Sam Kinison kind of thing where it's long, but kind of absent right around here, right? It's
long, but also thinning.
Right. Like, it's kind of lifeless. Riff-raff. Right. It doesn't have enough body because there isn't enough of it. So just kind of flopping around. But I'm trying to remember, when did he just say, like, I'm going to, like Travolta went this through this as well, where just suddenly they have an interesting, like, helmet hair that is in all their movies. Like, what I'm trying to think what the film was where it suddenly he has that style of hair. Do you guys have any ideas? I don't even know. The Rock?
I don't know. I think he was definitely shorter for The Rock, but he...
Yes.
I suppose at the time he was born in, when was it, 64? So he would have been early 23, right about the filming time of this when it was released. So I'm trying to think, by going through the filmography, and I'm utilizing all the powers of my photographic hair memory.
By the power of Grayskull.
By the power of Visible Skull. I mean, he still had a decent head of hair towards the mid-90s. Leaving Las Vegas, he had some decent hair there. The Rock, but
that was fake. By the late 90s, it is clearly it's a wig.
Was Sean Connery-ing it.
He was Sean Connery-ing it. He absolutely was. I'm going to look, Wild at Heart. I think he went on some talk show. The famous crazy interview with a leather jacket. Yeah. He's not wearing a rug in that, and you can see he's got like two hairs flopping around.
like it just here.
He's Simply Red or somebody.
The famous Terry Wogan, the UK's own Terry Wogan. Back at that time, it was a very conservative style of interview, and we did not know what to do with wild men other than just be like, well, that was quite energetic, wasn't it? in a very repressed British way.
Well, that's kind of what we think of as Nicolas Cage, as his, like, mm-hmm. the craziness of that interview. But for no other reason, go back and just look at his hair, and you can see there ain't much there. It's long but thin.
It's long but thin. It's all over the shop, depending on stress. I think it was around the mid-90s where he started to have the shorter hair. Because I think he had something of like a little widow's peak going on.
Magically, right.
And then there was a point of time around the mid-2010s when it was like just dyed black.
Yes.
That's always a good look. That's always a good look.
He thought, I wouldn't notice. I did. And then we get back to... I guess it was the very late 2010s, 2020s, and where once was a peak is now like a straight line. So I think I think the power of dollar bills in Hollywood, he's had a little something done.
And I always think of like Sean Connery in Dr. No was basically bald, but his rug was dynamite. It was like the apex of rug technology, and it seems like it's the technology's been lost in antiquity. Like
Cage is going to the Halloween store and getting the $5 Barbie hair rug.
That's possible. That's
Sean Connery and like Time Bandits, suddenly now he has dark curly hair, and it still looks great. Clearly not his hair. Never in his life did he have this color hair with big curly locks. Still looks fantastic.
That's the power of MI6 technology.
Absolutely, it is.
If Nicolas Cage was a Secret Service agent, he was, you know, fighting for his country behind enemy lines, then maybe he would have been treated with the follicle respect he deserved.
Yeah, he's getting CIA technology instead.
Respect. Yeah.
He's on that CIA budget, not the good stuff. Definitely not the good stuff. As I've already said, obviously the Hawaiian shirts as well are, you know, some top notch Hawaiian shirt stuff going on there as well, which beautiful. I think
majestic.
Definitely majestic, which I think maybe somewhere deep in my subconscious, maybe I saw Raising Arizona at a young age and I was like, this man's got it. This man knows what looks good, and he's been with me all that time. He'll be with me at the start, with me at the end when he takes my soul as well. it's the straight line of Cage connection. The Hawaiian shirt to Cage execution is a straight path.
Time is a flat circle, no question. He was with. It's like there's only one set of footprints on the beach, and those are the moments when Nick Cage carries you.
carries me to that sunset, carries me out to that sweet wave.
Oh God!
That's exactly the exit that I want.
Can we talk about this movie?
No, I refuse. No.
I love the prologue of this movie, which goes, it's like a 20-minute prologue, just kind of introducing us to all the crazy characters. And it is freaking hilarious. From mm-hmm. stem to stern, it is dynamite. I love it. It gets you right in the mood. Because then right after the prologue, it's they're right outside the Arizona household with the ladder ready to steal the kids.
Right. There's boom. No fucking around. It's like boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, they move. It moves at a quick pace. It takes, 5-10 minutes to get you caught up. Like H.I. McDonough, he's a continuous criminal, keeps getting arrested. He never gets arrested for armed robbery because he doesn't use live rounds.
Right.
Always lying to the parole board, telling them what they want to hear. And then he meets Ed, played by Holly Hunter, just falls in love with her every time he gets those photos taken. Her fiance has left
her. Her fiance! Oh, I love it.
And the more he gets arrested, the more he falls in love. He learns her life story. And it's like, I'm going to be waiting for you. And then they fall in love. And as we've mentioned, the doctor explained that her insides were a rocky place where his seed could find no purchase. And then we learn of the biggest news. Are they in Southwest Arizona? I think they said in the film. It is the news of the Quints. The Arizona Quints have been born. Their father is Nathan Arizona, who owns Arizona.
Unpainted Arizona.
Unpainted Arizona.
The largest chain of unpainted furniture in the Southwest.
I mean, is that a thing in the UK that you go to these places where you can buy furniture, but then you gotta sand it and paint it and finish it?
I don't think we have like anything that out there.
Who the hell would want that?
It's terrible. I bought a bookcase once, and then you spend twice as much, and it looks like shit. I'd rather somebody else paint it, and I'll pay just a little bit more.
We have IKEA.
We have that as well.
I wish I had IKEA. It's 2 hours away is the closest one.
I think you're never more than a 2-hour drive from an IKEA.
Yeah.
That is true. At least they paint their shit, though. I don't want to turn out of my furniture. Yeah. I don't want to be like crafting and shit.
It still goes in the trash every 2 years. Thank you, IKEA,
for your
sustainability.
It's good for the environment.
My laptop currently on a IKEA desk, no less.
As is mine, my COVID desk I ordered. It only took them 2 months to deliver it.
That to make sure all the screws are in there.
Except for one.
There's always one bit of the puzzle missing, and you don't need it, but you can't help but thinking it's going to come in handy at some point.
Right.
No calamities yet. And I will say, painted as well. Didn't have to paint it, didn't have to stand it. So 1-0 Daryl, 0 Nathan Arizona. Thank you very much. Now, I don't think we've got any... We certainly don't have that local TV commercial kind of thing. Because anytime I see that stuff on like YouTube, I'm like, this is insane. You just let small business owners, you just give them a camera and they do whatever they want. They throw some shit on iMovie.
Yes.
100%. We have the most... And the smaller the community, the more embarrassing the ad.
I couldn't... I just don't think, like, it could not function here in the UK. We just wouldn't have it. Like, no. The community outrage is too strong.
the outrage. The pickets. I mean, there's protests. Absolutely.
It's like, look, we will go to your store, advertise it, like, on a newspaper or something, but don't. Like, one, how did you get local advertising on TV? That does not happen here.
Oh, no, it's just money. You can put anything out there as long as you're willing to write the check.
Well, the country's so big that you have to have local stations, you know what I mean? And it's just like, in England, it's like 4 hours to drive across the nation. So a local commercial is basically covering a huge percentage of the nation, frankly.
You get a local commercial and probably 30% of the nation has heard about it.
Right.
Or you just do something ridiculous. I think it works like the fish and chip shop and like fast food takeaways and stuff. You just do like a platter of food that's a little bit big, and we lose our minds for that shit. We will travel up and down the country for that. we're not equipped to like gently support small business. We will give you all our money for a month, and then you go bankrupt the next month.
That's right. We're like, that's it.
Life comes at you fast here. Very, very fast, and then we all just like die because we're all repressed emotionally. We're like, oh, at least those fish and chips were good. Flatline, die. That's
fact, we've had enough. Something new has opened up. The only thing better than local ads is local news, of course. Every tiny community has their own news station, and it's ridiculous. Hey, there's Sam from the show and show coming over. What are you doing this weekend?
Is that your Arizona accent? I don't know what that
was. That's my Bakersfield accent. It's just hours and hours of nonsense. And what are the vets doing? It's always, what are the veterans doing?
What are the veterans up to? Are they buying unpainted
furniture?
They're
having a fucking barbecue or something. Come support their whatever.
Fireworks and barbecue is the American dream.
Yeah, pretty much. That's how we do it.
Fireworks, barbecues, mm-hmm. or you have quintuplets, makes the Southwest Arizona news, and then you've got a particularly desperate couple who think, well, five babies is too many. I'm going to take one of those babies. And I think if I took the names down correctly, we had Harry, Barry, Larry, Gary, and Nathan Jr.
That's correct. Well, there was a newspaper report where it says, more than we can handle, mom jokes. So that was kind of their justification for child abduction. Can we talk about also how the crib seemed patently unsafe? One side was like much lower, and the kids were literally able to just jump out of the crib onto the concrete or whatever it was.
It was a different time.
I guess.
The crib unsafe. Security of 1987, not up to code, if you ask me.
There was no baby gates or anything. Kids are like about to roll down the hard stairs. Nicolas Cage saved lives, if you ask me, frankly.
You know, by committing
a crime. Bones are still soft then. They just kind of bounce. And then there was that whole in 87, wasn't that whole Darwin thing? You have five, and then nature just takes care of the weaker ones.
Darwinism at its finest. and they, to Cage's own words, they got the best one. And they take the baby book. He's like, I got the instructions.
Dr. Spock, not to be confused with Mr. Spock.
I used to always say Mr. Spock. They're like, no, it's Dr. Spock.
I'm sure Leonard Nimoy has his opinions on child rearing as well.
I'd like to read that book, please.
I want to know what the Star Trek cast thinks about child abduction. That's what I want to know.
I'm sure they're against it, if I had to guess.
Mr. Sulu, answer me immediately. Where do you stand on this? I think it's fine. Then they get the best one. They get Nathan Jr. At this time, the Snotes brothers, Gail and Evel Snotes, John Goodman and William Forsythe escape
always
from prison.
The best names.
And if you like John Goodman screaming, you will love Raising Arizona. Oh boy, does that man have some pipes.
He does.
And John Goodman was an icon then. I mean, he was on Roseanne, which was like the number one like show in the nation.
Yeah, I mean, he was in movies and on TV. He bounced.
He was in Big Easy. He was in Sea of Love. He was in a bunch of movies.
He was in Revenge of the Nerds, also in Arizona.
So was he the coach or something
like
that?
He was the football coach. Revenge of the Nerds. Oh, good time.
I remember like John Goodman just being like kind of everywhere sort of, you know, in the 90s and everything, and everyone just loved John Goodman. And then did Roseanne like come back for like a season, but then Roseanne said some questionable things and it was Roseanne without Roseanne.
Oh. She had some mental illness issues, but yes. She always kind of popped off. But that was part of her telling it like it is situation. I think she got a little unfairly canceled, but they were ready to pull the trigger.
Anti-Semitic stuff as well.
Oh, did she?
She wasn't just a Trump supporter.
Then that's bad. But
that's bad. Yes.
It seems like they brought her back and were all set for her to fail. Like, they needed her just long enough to get the show going with all intentions of kicking her ass out.
Yeah, just set, get the table set, and then it's okay, Roseanne. We'll let John Goodman take it from here if you don't
mind. Is that show still on? The Conners?
I don't even watch terrestrial TV anymore. I feel like...
Humble brag.
It's a wonder I knew about the hurricane. I'm very special.
John Goodman, obviously a frequent collaborator with the Coens as well.
Yes.
I always found it a shame that Nicolas Cage and the Coens didn't do more stuff together. But they said that it was a respectful but turbulent relationship. I think Cage wanted to offer some ideas and improvise.
Oh, I bet he did. I can't imagine him sitting quietly.
Oh, no. Even in early Cage, obviously very early in both their careers, but even then, I think the Coens pretty much had their voice even then, and they knew, like, this is the vision, this is how it has to be. He said, I've learned how difficult it is to accept another artist's vision. They have an autocratic nature. Although the Coens did say it was fun working with Nick, they understand why Cage would say it was autocratic working with them. I think a lot of his improvisations that weren't scripted, they had to cut out, but they liked the fact that he had what they called a fertile imagination. So it wasn't Rocky Balboa.
This is all. He was an asshole and we will never work with him again, but let's come up with some magic words that make it sound like it was all good.
To make it was very fair, all very nice. Everyone got on together.
The one they really had trouble with was Randall Tex Cobb, the guy who played Leonard Smalls, the biker, the warthog from hell, as Holly Hunter calls him. Well, problem is, he's not really an actor. He was like a boxer turned actor. I mean, he was in shit after this and before this, but evidently he was totally a loose cannon. And they were just like, okay, we're good.
Let's put a real baby in the bassinet as I roll up and snatch it.
How many times can a baby roll off the hood or the roof of the car and crash onto the road and be perfectly okay? Good Lord.
Turns out the answer is once. I mean, they did say that Cage had a fertile imagination, and they said, we'd rather have that than people whose performance needed to be kick-started, which might be a thinly veiled jab at Randall Cobb as well. They said he was a force of nature on set. They did also say he couldn't actually ride a motorcycle. And on his first day of filming, he broke his shoulder. So basically for all his pretty much all of his scenes in the film, he was under the heavy influence of painkillers.
Oh, shit.
To make it through the filming of this one. So if you're wondering why it's so intense, painkillers do a lot for a performance, apparently.
That'll do it every time. Now, let me ask you this. This is never fully explained in the movie, but what do you think the connection is between H.I. and Leonard Smalls' tattoo, the Woody Woodpecker tattoo? Because Nicolas Cage discovers it, and it's like, oh, this is a grand revelation. Does that mean anything, I wonder?
I'm going to say yes, and then assume women or film viewers smarter than me can sort of figure out what it means. I was sort of wondering about this. I think it's meant to be there's some kind of connection between them.
Right.
But I think the whole thing with the lone biker of the apocalypse is that I think it's implied at the start that, you know, H.I. starts having all these like negative dreams about things going wrong and like flames and the bike going through the flames. And I think it's his own, because he's someone who stands in his own way throughout the entire film. Like, he wants to be better, but he just can't. He's just not willing to.
Oh, I think I see. I know where you're going. I'll go. Keep going.
And I will. I'll ride my mouth. So, it's kind of implied that he manifests him and is, I guess, he's his physical embodiment of all this like negativity that he harbors for himself and all the things that he's sort of afraid to lose. And then I think it's this kind of symbolism that I guess Smalls is like the worst parts of him that he wants to sort of fight, that he has to overcome. And by through the modern miracle that is the grenade, he's sort of able to overcome this and see what's most important, which is, you know, seeing his wife, soon to be, hopefully in the future, if he has that vision, you know, mother right. of children as well. So I think a lot of this film is him learning to step out of his own way, learning that the family unit can be a flawed thing as well. But also,
you went deep with this, brother.
I did. I made all this up.
No, I think you're on the right path. I mean, it's this is the trajectory his life is going towards, unless you make a change. This is you in the future.
So this is what, like, your hair will go shorter and curlier. It won't move around when you're stressed.
It will get thicker.
He wishes.
He wishes. He absolutely wishes.
I still laugh at that scene where the lone biker of the apocalypse throws the grenade and then the little bunny rabbit scampers up to it like a mushroom cloud. Hilarious.
Bless the Coen brothers.
Yeah, I said Lenny Smalls, he just has a hatred for like smaller things. He's throwing grenades at rabbits. He's throwing grenades at little lizards as well.
Right.
Yes.
I think I've read, I think some people got upset that animals got like blown up, but they said, obviously this is a very small budget picture. So apparently what they actually did is that it was a live wizard that they, a lizard.
a very small wizard.
A tiny, tiny little reptile wizard that they just had on a wire. When the explosion went off, they just yanked it off screen. So I'm going to assume there was some kind of animal laws that made it was safe to do so, or if not, don't tell anyone. That
keep it on the DL. Exactly. Those slip sync ships.
On the down lizard.
On the down lizard.
The lizards have been talking.
I wrote down, mind his little fontanelle, because that is something I say all the time for no reason at all, apropos of nothing. I think that's hilarious.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think it's what you said, there's a lot of really good just quotable lines on this. I think I did write down a few, and one of mine was like, son, you got a panty on your head.
I wrote that down too. I mean, that whole scene is amazing. From the moment chase. He tries to rob the shortstop, evidently H.I. McDonough only robs like convenience stores. That's his thing. The 7-Elevens or whatever of the area, the shortstops. And when his wife ditches him and the cops pull up and are just shooting, bam, bam, bam. He runs into a house. They're just shooting at the house. There's a family in there. That whole scene is so, the dogs are chasing him.
Pack of dogs, yeah.
He's got the diapers.
Yodeling score is going on as well.
Oh my god, I love that. I love that score. It is so insane.
The score is great. Like that's a real highlight. He's got the panties on, going to get like the way he just very nonchalantly walks to the counter, is like, I'll take these huggies and whatever cash you've got in that there register. And then Ed's just watching, going, that son of a bitch. Yes, son of a bitch. And just drives off. And I love that bit where they're going through the house and the camera's just like chasing them through as well.
And the family's just sitting there watching TV, like oblivious to like people like Nicolas Cage running by and the cops shooting. And the dogs run through the house. So it is amazing.
It's a perfect film.
He's running through the supermarket. Running and the cops just shooting down every aisle.
Stuff is exploding down their glass.
All the ladies have got curlers in their hair out for a late night shop at the convenience store.
Double coupons.
The convenience store's got like this massive guy working. He's got just a massive hand cannon. He gets attacked by dogs. police are falling out of their cars when they're like spinning round. It's like this film is basically, I think it was described as basically just a Looney Tunes live action cartoon.
Yeah. It's
just controlled chaos that feels like it could just explode.
You need anvil falling on someone's head.
Absolutely. Well, and the other thing about Coen Brothers movies after this is even the ones that had kind of comedic elements were very dark. Like if you watch Fargo, for example.
Which I love, Fargo.
Which has funny moments, like legitimately funny moments. It also has people getting shoved in the wood chipper.
Yes.
It goes, you get whiplash from the changes of tone. Where this, even though it deals with child abduction and murder and mayhem, theoretically, it's all played very light.
Yes.
And goofy almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Because this deals with, like, you know, we joke about it, but it deals with child abduction and there's escaped convicts and everyone keeps getting really attached to this, like, kid.
Yes.
And then there's the biker of the apocalypse who's kind of this, I guess, like, internal manifestation of his own toxicity in this karmic battle. And there's a lot of, like, elements which on paper you'd probably read that and think, this movie is trying to fall off the rails at every conceivable turn. Nick Cage won't stop improvising. Will someone please listen to me? But it gives you just like a great appreciation, because I think this was, you know, Nick Cage was great in movies before this. I think he'd just done Peggy Sue Got Married before this. Where?
Right.
Yeah.
I think apparently he, on the set of Peggy Sue Got Married, he stole a dog at one point as well. So maybe that was sort of the unspoken thing that, like, why the Coens didn't want to work with him again, is trying to get out of his dog stealing ways.
And I think he almost got fired from Peggy Sue Got Married, which was directed by his uncle, Francis Ford Coppola, because he made a weird artistic choice to have his character speak with a crazy voice the entire. It's a weird.
God, it's all coming back to me. Oh, yeah.
Nicolas Cage was making choices even then. Even then, he was making these choices.
And, you know, we were only. And then after this, like his next film after this same year, 87, was Moonstruck as well. So.
Oh, my God, that was so good.
87, Raising Arizona and Moonstruck for Cage.
That's a good year.
Good year for Cage. Then 1988, Vampire's Kiss. Great year for Cage.
I have not seen that. We got to put that on the list, Kevin.
Oh, Vampire's Kiss. Yes. Nothing but net.
I saw that at the video store like soon after, like late 80s, early 90s. Because I thought it was like going to be like a horror movie or something. And it is. Kind of, in a uniquely Nicolas Cage sort of way. I mean, there are certain movies of Nick Cage that you have to watch just for the pure Nick Cage-iness of it.
Yeah.
And that's Vampire's Kiss. Deadfall a few years later is another one. I made my daughter watch The Wicker Man.
Oh, yeah. There's some choices there.
That's actually called good parenting, if I may interject.
That's what I told CPS. Child so for the first like hour or plus of The Wicker Man, it's pretty subdued Cage. You're like, okay, so it's just kind of a standard thriller. And then the switch is flipped, and now he's bonkers, wearing a bear costume. He's carjacking somebody at gunpoint for their bicycle. He's kicking in doors. He's punching people where you're like, what is happening? He kicked Lily Sobieski against the wall. It is dynamite. It's the whole thing.
There's like a twinkle in his eye that indicates now his brain is broken, and away he goes.
Yes.
The Wicker Man really is a story of a small community coming together to defend themselves from a mentally unstable man who attacks their way of life.
Yes! Not the bees!
Was he tricked? Was he tricked to go there? Yes. But also, he was a threat to everyone.
That's what I said.
He's the real villain of the piece when you really think about it.
At some point, you understand why they put him in the Wicker Man. No question.
Just to get rid of him. Just to stop the insanity.
They were going to send him back to America with a little gift basket of honey, but nope, he had to start kicking all those women. Gone off lightly, if you ask me. Gone off lightly. But yeah, I think that there are some movies, I think almost there are some Cage movies. I've said this before on the podcast where I think you almost have to watch them once just to get the Cage factor out of the way, like Vampire's Kiss. Because I've had it from people like, I watched Vampire's Kiss for the first time. What the fuck was that? That was batshit. That was insane. And then they've watched it like a few other times and they're like, you know what? It's actually kind of good.
Now that you mentioned
it. I just got back from the bar and I popped it on again and now it's not so bad.
I've only ever watched it 12 beers deep, but don't let that be the off-putting factoid. And I will say I'm a Vampire's Kiss defender. I do think I've seen it too many times. Same as Deadfall. I don't think that's a good film, but I've seen it too many times is the point that I'm making there.
Right.
But it's Raised in Arizona. I think it's probably been about 3 years since I saw this. And it's one of those films, it just holds up. There's just something kind of timeless about it. It's got the Coen sort of written all over it. Mm-hmm. You can see the formulations of like early Cage and early Coen here as well. And for some people in the film business, they're big fans of this. Matthew McConaughey has said it's one of his favorite films of all time and a film that he quotes all the time. Filmmaker Ed Wright have said it's his absolute favorite film of all time as well. Matthew McConaughey said he's watched this film more than any other. So I just like the idea of Matthew McConaughey just like quit Doctor Explain all their insides were a rocky place.
I like to think he just has like this big projector in his bedroom and that before he does the deed with his ladies, they're forced to just watch
his ladies.
Ladies, I like plural. Plural. Sunday night's plural, Nick Cage night, exactly. Ladies.
All right.
On Sunday, we watch Raising Arizona. All right.
This movie.
Now, what about Renfield? I'm sorry. I'm making a divert. Have you guys seen Renfield, the new Nick Cage?
Yes, indeed.
All right. Do you recommend it?
I think it's good. I think it deserved better at the box office.
Okay.
But I think it's. And this, you know, this, take this for what it's worth, coming from someone like me, needed more Cage. I can say that about any film that he's in. I think Cage does a good Dracula. There's a lot of Cageisms in there as well. Like, I don't want to spoil too much, but just the little Cage inflections in the way he does Dracula stuff. Like, he just says the word okay, he goes, okay. The scenes with him and Nicholas Hoult are like the strongest ones in the film, but it's good. It's decent. It's a nice 90 minutes. Spend the time. I liked it.
So it's okay. It's HBO level. I don't need to run anywhere. I don't need to see it at the theater.
Well, if you're going to, it's a little late.
So how dare you, sir?
The movie's not in theaters anymore, as far as I know. Maybe Matthew McConaughey's private theater. Who's to say?
/ sex dungeon.
I mean,
you have this elaborate mythology for Matthew McConaughey's lifestyle. Who's to say?
I think he probably smells bad. Like,
Brad Pitt?
Who was Brad Pitt? I assume they smell very similar. Like unwashed, maybe a little touch of mildew. Yeah.
A touch of mildew.
Because their clothes are just dirty.
Just a touch. I imagine Matthew McConaughey smells like barbecue at all times.
And whiskey.
Yeah, he gives me...
And cigars.
There's always sauce on his fingers. Always. There's no sauce near, but there's always sauce on his fingers. We don't know how he got there.
Maybe he has Cheetos fingers or Doritos fingers where they're just permanently stained orange.
This just sounds disgusting.
Exactly.
Matthew
McConaughey. That's how you get in the sex dungeon.
You gotta think like a sex pest to get in with a sex pest. That's how it works.
I have other lines from this movie.
I bet you do.
Well, it's just that I say spontaneously. They just come out of me at often the wrong time, frankly.
At the holidays.
At the holidays. You've been up to the devil's business? I say that all the time.
I'm going
to
work that in this week.
No question. Knock back a couple of cocos. Still say that. I'm going to head out with the boys. Knock back a couple of cocos.
The only man who could say Coca-Cola by missing out 90% of the letters.
Right. It is freaking hilarious from stem to stern. That's all I can say. And it has a nice message. You know, it's about family. And I appreciate Nathan Arizona basically forgiving them, just waving away their sins for abducting his son for how long? How long was this child abducted? It's unclear, but too long, some would argue.
And I would argue that's not how police and the law works. If they've been out searching for your missing child, it's not for you to say, no, someone's still going to jail.
With the federal BI?
Yeah, the FBI working on it. They're like, we're cool? Oh, okay. Later.
So, you know what? Five is too many. We'll all laugh about this in a few months from now. We'll look back and think, what a caper.
Maybe those are the two children. They decided that three is enough, and a basket arrives in front of the trailer with a couple of extra kids in it.
Right. Why didn't Nathan just say, you know what? Keep this one. We're good. No harm done.
Yeah. We think something's wrong with this one, so take that one too.
We think something's wrong. Exactly. No question.
This is why he didn't get a rhyming name. Trying to think of the other quotes. When the snouts hold up the bank, they're like, right, everybody freeze, everybody get down on the ground. And I got, well, which is it, young fella? You want I should freeze or get down on the ground? Me to say, if and I freeze, I can't rightly drop. And if and I drop, I'm going to be in motion.
That was so classic.
Did you notice there was the reoccurring motif of people constantly saying, well, okay then.
Okay.
Okay then. It's like if you listen, about 10 different people say it like 10 different times throughout this thing, including
that guy.
I'm saying
that at my staff meeting tomorrow. I'm saying that at my staff meeting. Well, okay then. And then wasn't there a quote, his boss's wife, like when she wanted to steal the babies, there was a quote about our kids are too big to snuggle.
Too big to cuddle.
Too big to cuddle.
Too big to cuddle.
I say that to our sister all the time who has twins. I'm like, these kids are too big to cuddle. We need another baby in the family.
That whole scene where Frances McDormand and Sam McMurray show up with their psychotic kids and are just wrecking the house, destroying the house. And there's a scene where Sam McMurray takes, I don't know what those are, marbles, jelly beans, and says, hit the deck, boy, and just throws them at the kids. Hilarious.
Oh, my Dynamite. God. He went on to do a ton of shit in the 80s on Fox. Remember when Fox just appeared?
He was on the Tracy Ullman show.
Yeah, it was a Tracy Ullman show that rolled into becoming The Simpsons. I love Tracy Ullman.
And now here we are. No Tracy Ullman in sight.
Womp womp.
Womp womp indeed. Womp womp. There's right and there's what's right, and never the twain shall meet.
Never the twain shall meet. Well, and really, this was Holly Hunter's thing. When Nick Cage comes back and says, it was kind of terrifying, honey. She sends his ass right back to get a kid. She says, you know, they got more than they can handle. So
you go.
She had the baby fever.
She's lost all. What was it? She lost all interest in law enforcement and house cleaning.
Oh, I mean, it's just perfect. It's just perfect. We can just go step by step, line by line. It's just perfect.
It's a great movie. It's one, I think my top Cage films are always very interchangeable, but I think I'd argue that Raising Arizona has got to be my top Cage movies thereabouts. And I'd say, like, I thought the ending was very sweet as well. He's finally having those good dreams.
Yes.
He's finally dreaming of a positive future. He's dreaming that no one believes his foreman, that he stole the baby. He's dreaming that they're supporting Nathan Jr. from afar and influencing his burgeoning football career, his American football career.
Yes.
And that they will have kids and grandkids that mm-hmm. will come round, and they'll have a lovely family, but it might have to be in Utah.
In Utah! I'd forgotten that line! That was
maybe in Utah.
Hilarious. That's... And Glenn may have told the wrong Pollock joke to the wrong police officer at the wrong time.
One too many Pollock jokes. He's finally getting written up after all this time.
And they were the worst jokes ever. They were it was like,
didn't know how to tell it.
Well, I told it wrong. I told it wrong. Why does it take three Pollocks to unscrew a light bulb? Because they're so darn stupid.
It's so fucking terrible.
There's only two things that man wants. He wants to tell Pollock jokes, and he wants to fuck your wife.
Yes. T-I-G-E-R. She's a Hellcat.
Francis McDormand playing his wife as well. They are swinging.
She's the best. She's a touch of gold. If she's in something, you know it's going to be amazing.
She is.
Giving all that unsolicited parenting advice while squirting all that mustard down.
Gotta get your dip tat. What about the dip tat, honey?
we could just break this down on a line by line.
You
could!
100%. 100%. This is a 12-hour podcast. Let's start at the beginning.
Do like a commentary, frankly.
We can do it. It's like Mystery Science Theater 3000, but we start off singing the opening song. I used to do that all the time just to annoy my husband.
You yodel? Yeah. Again, Arizona is not Montgomery, Alabama, right?
Where it's not a yodeling state.
It's not a yodeling state, typically. Not typically.
But there was the yodeling cowboy
yes.
thing in like the 30s and 40s. So not maybe they think, not from Arizona. Is that a Texas yodeling thing? I don't know.
I think, unfortunately, the time of the yodeler has come and gone. Whoa! I mean, I'm making a big statement, but I think the yodeler has had their day. I think has had their day. So, you know.
Do these balloons blow up in funny shapes? No, unless round is funny. I just love it. I can't even contain myself. It is so every line. I mean, and you can understand why the Coen brothers are like, no, we're not improvising. Yeah. We have written this thing meticulously.
It's our magnum opus.
It is. It may seem free and easy, but we have cultivated this, to the minute detail.
Yeah. So Nick Cage, are not the one who's going to fuck it up.
Don't do some vampires kiss shit on this.
It's crazy to think that they just put this movie out because they needed to make some money as well. They needed a commercial film, which they, you know, they've been very open about, basically say like, hell yeah, we sold out for this movie. But it's, you know, it's arguably,
what a way to sell out, man.
What a way to sell out.
They were hungry, so they put their best absolute effort forth.
Well, what was it? Was it they were trying to get money to make Fargo? Was that the movie? I'm trying to remember what the movie was that they were trying to make. It was like a $40 million movie.
I don't know.
It was a movie they made later, but they couldn't have, at that time, they didn't have the cachet to make that movie. So then they whipped up this one.
Yeah, it might have been the Hudsucker Proxy, maybe.
They could have saved that money.
You could argue it needed a little more Nick Cage.
More cowbell.
Well, there's that metal sheet factory where he works, and if you look on the overalls, it says like Hudsucker on there.
Right.
So the Cage multiverse is very real. I've been preaching this for years. You know. The multiverse of sadness exists.
The multiverse of sadness. Exactly.
It's very, very real. But, you know, some may say that the Coen brothers peaked very early. I see a lot of reviews saying this is a very optimistic and heartwarming movie. And it's just a zany screwball comedy as well. And I think a lot of it, I agree with. This is a film that, you know, a lot of it warms your heart. There's fantastic lines and moments. All the performances are great. I completely bought into the relationship of the McDonoughs, mm-hmm. H.I. Herbert McDonough and Ed as well. It's still like 90% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes to this day as well. So
yes,
with more people, it's one of those, you know, even like Roger Ebert, who's usually quite a big Cage defender, was not a fan of this when it came out.
Usually Ebert and I are like one-on-one, but sometimes he can be wrong.
No.
Sometimes he can be wrong.
Sometimes he can be wrong. He wrote a negative review, did Mr. Ebert. He said the film stretches out every moment for more than it's worth until even the moments of inspiration seem forced. Since the basic idea of the movie is a good one and there are talented people in the cast, what we have here is a film shot down by its own forced and mannered style.
What? Well, I'm thinking he probably was in a car accident earlier in that day, and there's probably some head trauma, because why else would you write such a review? There's no other explanation.
I know. It's like, you know, sometimes, you know, he's obviously recognized as like a god tier. I think he gave it, I'm not sure how many stars his ratings are. I think it's 4 stars. He gave it 1.5.
Oh my God. Crazy. That's right up there. Like I spit on your grave or something. Dear Jesus.
Yeah. Roger Ebert, usually quite a big Cage defender as well, but he was not a fan this time around.
You know what? I'm throwing all my weight behind Rex Reed from now on after that review. No more Roger Ebert. He's dead to us. No question. This movie
he's dead to everybody, actually, at this point.
That
metaphorically and physically.
But I think this movie, I just watched it the other day. I think it's good for the whole family. Truly. There really isn't anything objectionable that you couldn't have your kids watch. I think somebody says the F word once, if I'm remembering, and it's M. Emmett Walsh describing a car accident where the guy had the fucking head in his hand or something like that. But other than that, there's really nothing, and it's wacky. I think, you know, it should be a Christmas tradition, frankly.
I think it should be a monthly tradition.
Just on a loop.
I think if you took a certain selection of Cage films and you said, like, these are, I don't know, the 3, 4, 5 that are a good introduction to Cage, give you a good scope of what the man's all about, I think you'd have to throw Raising Arizona in there, because this is something I say all the time as well. I think, you know, your surface level, you think of Cage as like the shouty, screamy guy who's taking right. any movie that people throw at him. But you always forget with films like this as well that Cage is pretty good at all genres that he does, and he's very good at comedy as well. I think we forget that Cage is very good at doing comedy as well. So between this and, say, like The Weatherman, for me, are two of my favorite Cage comedy performances, which still hold up for me. And I think this would be one of the ones, like, look, you want the Cage crash course, you want the triple C, Raising Arizona.
got to be on there for you as well. Got to be on there for you as well.
I agree. I agree. You have to really appreciate the German expressionistic, shamanistic acting style that he has cultivated over his career. Am I right?
No one else was doing it like Cage then. No one else is doing it like Cage now.
No one. No one. There's some leading men types who just kind of show up, do their thing, cash a check. Nicolas Cage, you know, he's always making choices. He's always, and sometimes they're off the wall choices, but they're always interesting. At the very least, they're always interesting.
Like Face Off. There was a lot of choices there.
Okay, going off on this tangent, what did you think of Nicolas Cage in Face Off?
I thought Nicolas Cage in Face Off was fantastic.
Fantastic!
Fantastic.
This is what I thought. And as you know, I'm a Cage defender. I thought John Travolta kind of blows him off the screen in that movie because he had to play kind of the, for most of the movie, kind of the less interesting role. You know what I mean? He has to play like, you know, I'm dour all the time. Oh, I'm bummed. You know, whereas John Travolta gets to play Nicolas Cage. He gets to be wacky and zany the entire
movie. Exactly what you said right there. John Travolta has to play Cage to out Cage Cage.
Yes. Yes.
Well, whereas Cage did not put in the same quiet effort.
I don't know if it's an effort issue. I always said it was kind of, I thought it was the writing. The writing didn't make the character kind of interesting or fun.
Right.
It made it just kind of boring and irritating. I don't know.
I mean, I've recently recovered Face Off on the podcast. It's one like when you start going through it with a fine tooth comb, one of the most insane films you will ever see. Doesn't make any sense.
No fucking sense.
But I think because the film itself is so ridiculous, the performances have to be on par or just top it to sell that. Yeah, we can just go and take people's faces off.
Fine. And give you 70 pounds.
gain 70 pounds. Have
and
people.
2 inches.
And two inches at highs. And then when you switch back, make sure to put my 70 pounds back on, if you don't mind.
put my penis back on as well, please.
Put my penis.
We talked about it on our show as well. And we especially liked how when John Travolta is evil, he basically becomes a doting husband who goes
better
to
father.
Work every day and a father, is home every night in bed with his wife. Up early, clean shaven to go to work, working for the law enforcement.
And doing a good job.
And doing a good job.
He was gathering too many criminals and was cracking heads.
And he disarms his own bomb for no reason. He's like, oh God, Face Off. Anyway, sorry.
The real crime was that he did a better job than actual John Travolta did.
Yes.
So real John Travolta goes back and is like, but the bad one of you was better. You suck. You're so boring.
It is. Ooh. His wife's like, can I have the other one back?
Exactly.
Giving her feet rubs. Yeah.
This man used to make me dinners of spaghetti and lobster on the same
table. And he
table.
Was ripped. Nick Cage was like ripped in that movie.
I know. It's like that. Some say the wrong person got shot with a harpoon, but the Face Off sequel is coming out. The Face Off sequel is coming, so we'll have to see
face
what
on.
Happens there.
Face on.
Face on, Face Off. Nicolas Cage meets Mr. Miyagi. Face Off meets the Karate Kid.
I can't wait. And it'll be a crazy hairpiece, you know.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Like a Donald Trump where the part is over here and kind of lips across.
Kinda loop it around.
Awesome. Loop it around. Give it a
swirl. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything less than an outlandish hairpiece and I am walking out of that
screen. Throwing my soda at the screen and I'm out.
Popcorn bucket's gone in the air like, fuck it. I'm out.
I'm done. I'm out.
I'm out.
You have to get security. Seriously, I'm causing a ruckus at best.
You know, as we said before, there's what's right and there's what's right, and never the twain shall meet. But certainly in terms of, I think, coming towards the end of our recap on Raising Arizona, I think we've covered a lot, and I think it's fair to say what our opinions on this film are. But in our final thoughts, you know, we've come a long way since the Humanity Bureau. For you both, what are your final thoughts on 1987's Raising Arizona?
Aaron, go first. What do you think?
It's a 5 out of 5. It is a perfect film. Nothing should be changed. It should never be remade. There should be a law against Hollywood even speaking of such a blasphemy. It's a top Nick Cage, from his choice of eyebrows that matches insane hair. Every person cast in this film was perfect. It is the apex of Cage and of the Coen brothers.
It's like the two great flavors that taste great together. Is basically what it is, right?
It is a peanut butter cup.
It is, absolutely. Well, from jump, it is freaking hilarious. Now, I'm going to tell you, it is wild what is happening in this movie. It is kind of heightened reality, to say the least. Again, we talked about its child abduction, but done in a very light manner. The bad guys get what's coming to them, and the good guys, you know, Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter rediscover their love for each other by the end of the movie, and it's very optimistic, and they end up in Utah, perhaps. I would recommend it for, you know, everybody in your family. Your grandparents come to town, throw it in, the local clergy. It doesn't matter. If you're hosting some orphans, bring them in. Do it. It is great. I would recommend it completely and with no reservations.
Boom.
Absolutely. Mic drop moment there. The American Film Institute in 2000 put it on their number 31 in their AFI's 100 Years, 100 Laughs. So the institutes are recognizing it as well. And if you've not seen it, it's time that you recognized it also. Get Raising Arizona in your damn life, people.
But I think you better add two. Nathan Jr. accepts me.
Otherwise, I'll come and steal your babies myself. If the FBI is listening, I won't do that. I won't. I do not endorse. I do not endorse. If the federal BI is listening, I do not endorse, child. On that bombshell, it's left for me to say, Kevin and Aaron, thank you so much for once again taking this journey to true Cage Nirvana with me. A pleasure to have you back. And for the dear listeners, once again, where can we find you on the interwebs, the socials, and all that good business as well?
We're the hosts of the podcast That Wouldn't Die. We discuss guilty pleasures and forgotten classics of the horror and sci-fi genre with a comedic twist. We're on, you know, all your social media. You know, we're on TikTok, we're on Instagram, we're on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever it is called, Threads. And of course,
the platform formerly known as Twitter.
That is correct. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere the finer podcasts are available.
Fantastic stuff. And all the links down in the description, as per usual. So go and check them out and tell them your boy sent you. So with that said, it's time to wrap up here. So thank you for listening. If you have been, we will catch you in the next one. And until then, as ever, keep on caging. It's all you have to do. Thank you. Take care. And goodbye. And there you have it, folks. Dear, delightful Cage Ragers, my Cajun Spice boys and girls out there, we made it. It was worth the wait. I told you it would be. Raising Arizona. Ticked. Done. Dusted. In the box. So as I touched on at the start, we've got Arcadian coming. Looks to be dropping in April 2024. Long Legs, just a few months after. So we've got some
Potentially some big horror hitters in the Cage collection coming, which I'm very, very excited for. Of course, I've not been away from all things movie related. Obviously, things slow down with Cage, but we're still working at some stuff behind the scenes. As I mentioned earlier, the Dream Scenario episode is coming. Episode 5 of Cage Rage Revisited is in the bag. It is recorded, and it'll be up sooner than you think, as I will be covering 1996's action epic, The Rock, along with internet sensation and Avarian op-ed, Chad the Bird. That's right, I recorded a podcast with the bird. How many other podcasts are doing that? I'm just saying. So look out to that. Another absolute banger of an episode. And of course, if you don't know, I'm still very much active in the podcast verse. Me and fellow Cage acolyte Petros Patsilivas are very busy at work, bringing you Getting Defoe You, a dedicated Willem Dafoe podcast where we are covering season by season all the highs, all the lows, and all things Willem Dafoe. The third season, as of recording, has just started dropping. Very exciting times. You can also find us over at Patreon now, Getting Defoe You, on all the social medias at Defoe You Pod. So get involved. Very exciting times. We've got some big things coming. Lots of things in the plans. Lots of things in the works. So get involved. We'd love to have you there. Love to have you here. Either on the journey to True Cage Nirvana, or aboard the Defoe Commotion train, or both, ideally, which would be delightful. Love to have you. Your boy sees you. Your boy appreciates you. We ain't done yet, people. We're still coming. We're still chugging along. And all the links to the Cage Rage social media down in the description, in the links, as per usual, on the old Twitter machine, at @Cage_podcast, and on TikTok and Instagram at Cage Rage Pod. If you enjoyed the episode, reach out. Let me know. Drop your boy a little old rating on Spotify, on Apple, on all the usual. The more people that like the podcast, the more it grows. The more it grows, the more algorithms it gets to. And the more people that are listening, the more people we get on the journey to True Cage Nirvana, the better it is for everyone. A bit more cage in the world is never a bad thing. But with that said, it's good to be back, people. And we'll see you in the next one. But until then, of course, and as ever, keep on caging. That's all you have to do. Thank you. Take care. And goodbye.